You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 14th of June 2017 on Monocle 24. Live from London, you're tuned to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Coming up today...
The EU and Eurozone are our best protection. So what we have to do is in a certain way to reset the model, to refund the model, and to say how we have to reinvent the EU and the Eurozone of the 21st century.
Just days before an uncertain Britain takes its seat at the European Union's negotiating table, the French president raises the possibility of a Brexit backpedal. Meanwhile, in the Gulf, Qatar's diplomatic downturn continues.
The nation of Qatar, unfortunately, has historically been a funder of terrorism.
There is no single evidence that the Qatar government is supporting radical Islamists.
With feuding in the White House hampering the international response, we'll look at what diplomatic options remain open for Qatar. Plus, from misguided Mexican waves to high-five faux pas, we'll assess why world leaders in fun mode is almost never a good idea. That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Yes, a warm welcome to Midori House. My guests today are the former British diplomat John Everard and Quentin Peel, Associate Fellow at Chatham House and contributor to the Financial Times. Gentlemen, welcome both to the programme. First, now, how to gauge the mood in the garden of the Elysee Palace? Yesterday, Britain's Prime Minister Theresa May was supposed to have ridden into Paris with a clear mandate, and consequently, one imagines, a clearer vision of how Britain's exit from the EU would play out. Instead, it was the French President Emmanuel Macron who used the opportunity to proffer some conciliatory words to his gloomy counterpart, even raising, apparently, the surely fanciful notion of Britain reversing its direction on the road to Brexit. Quentin Peel, I come to you first of all. I know it's not necessarily within Emmanuel Macron's personal gift, but were you surprised that he so explicitly said nothing is certain, this could still be rolled back?
I'm not totally surprised, because I think he regards Brexit as an insane policy for any serious nation to be indulging in. And therefore, he can't actually understand how a sensible government, you know, good, solid, conservative government, can actually be pursuing it. So I think probably he sort of almost couldn't restrain himself, unless he was teasing. But I actually think, and I think the same would hold for Germany, you know, they actually regard Britain plunging ahead with Brexit as just being living on another planet.
And John, it's interesting, isn't it? Because a lot of people, including some quite committed Remainers, have said, look, once Article 50 is triggered, you think of someone like Ken Clark, a former sort of Tory, you know, Tory grandee, who said, this is the end, there's no going back. But Quentin's right. Across the other European capitals, there's surely a mood that this does not represent good political sense. Does that, however, mean there's any substance to what Macron said?
Yes.
Is there going back on this?
There is a great deal of substance. Is there going back on this is a $64,000 question. The rule book is silent and particularly unhelpful on whether, having triggered Article 50, you can subsequently untrigger it. So if there's nothing in the rule book, it would have to go to the Council of Ministers of the EU for a decision. And what Macron is doing is signalling very strongly that for France's part, if the UK ever wanted to withdraw from the triggering of Article 50, France would vote in favour of that being allowed. Now, this raises... You quickly get into obscure theology on this. But if it goes to the Council of Ministers, one thing they would have to decide quickly would be whether it requires a unanimous decision by the Council of Ministers, in which case you've had it. I mean, Malta will block it because Malta blocks everything. Or whether it will go through on a qualified majority vote, in which case Macron, having now set out his stall, if you can get Merkel, if you can get the French and you can get the Italians and the Spanish on board, that's it. I mean, the door then is quite clearly open to a reversal of British policy if that is what the UK decides it wants to do, which, given the timescale we now face, who knows, might happen.
Quentin, what would these potential power brokers then need to see, do you think, to reassure them that Britain sort of really means it? Would it need to be a full second referendum massive swing, a decisive victory for Remain. Could a government on their own do it? I don't know. Let's be fanciful still. Corbyn in number 10, for example, leading a minority administration. Could they be convinced? And what would it take?
Well, I think what you're talking about is what would be needed to actually make it a tenable decision within Britain. Because as everybody can see, Britain is incredibly divided on this issue. Okay, it was said during the election that quite a lot of people who'd voted Remain to stay in the EU were now saying, oh, let's get it over with. But actually, nonetheless, there's a deep, deep division. And one of the reasons that Theresa May really had such a bad election was that an awful lot of young people not only voted for Corbyn, they voted for Corbyn in areas which had always been voting Remain. And I think young people are very, very angry about this decision. Now, is it possible politically to reverse it? It's quite difficult when the Labour Party is actually in a position of saying, no, it's done, we've got to go along with it. And that worked quite well for the Labour Party during the election campaign. The other figure you need to look at during the election campaign is that very hard-bitten Brexiters in UKIP, the United Kingdom Independence Party, collapsed, but their votes didn't all go to the Tories. They split about 50-50 and half their votes went to Labour. So Labour was quite clever to be still quite Brexity. So even though I would pray that this little glimmer of light that we have after the election, that the whole thing might be brought to a standstill, politically very difficult to see how it can be done.
I agree with Quentin, but I think there's another angle to all this as well. It's becoming clear, given the results of the election, that the hard Brexit outcome that might have been possible before the election is simply not deliverable domestically in terms of UK politics anymore. That the negotiating team are much more likely now to be given instructions to seek a soft Brexit with continued membership of the single market and probably sort of relationships of various kinds with various of the European institutions. Now, one of the paradoxes of all this is that a hard Brexit, although many of us might regard it as actually suicidal, is in negotiating terms not too difficult to achieve. You simply go into the negotiating room saying, ha ha, slash, burn, smash, and off you go. A soft Brexit, where you are having to ask the rest of the EU to let you keep on certain benefits of membership, is going to be much more difficult. Now, it's very possible that if the negotiating brief is for a soft Brexit, and as the clock ticks on, of course, there's not that much time left now, that sometime next year, the negotiating team goes back to central government and says, guys, we cannot deliver this. You know, we cannot do what you've asked us to do. You know, this is simply not going to happen. And given also that the horrible line of no deal, if we can't get a good deal is being thrown out, that then puts the government on the spot. And I think that might be a situation in which the government is forced to go into reverse gear, eat very large quantities of humble pie, and ask to withdraw Article 50.
Quentin, I sense that John is more optimistic than you. Another problem, presumably, would be that after all of this back and forth, it's in the interests of the 27 or the Council of Ministers as their proxy or whomsoever to, if not punish Britain, certainly sort of make it as unappetizing as possible. In a sense, whilst they'd be happy to have Britain back, they would presumably what? Would there be questions? Certainly not with the budget rebate. Other penalties, financial penalties, potentially. So again, one can't imagine your Brexiteers or even your less convinced Brexiteers stomaching a punitive deal, which is presumably what would be offered from the Brussels side.
Yeah, I would disagree about the use of the word punishment. I don't think that anybody on the continent is thinking punishment. People in this country are using the word because they're going to punish us, because we, like the Brits, have always seen Europe as a great battle. It isn't. It's actually a long
negotiation. What about then, I suppose my word was poorly chosen, what about a disincentive for future?
No, no, you're quite
for future
right,
countries
that
who are
they can't
the
bend over and say, you get all the benefits and none of the costs. They're not going to do that. They're going to say, if you leave the club, then you lose the benefits of the club. You are doing this to yourselves. You are not going to be in the single market if you refuse to have freedom of movement. That's clear. Or, you know, whatever. It's not going to, you can't cherry pick. Now, I think somebody like Macron, he's a pragmatist at heart. That's what he's created in France, is put this whole middle ground party together, neither left nor right. And I think he's a problem solver. So is Angela Merkel. These are two people who want to solve problems. They would like to go down the road of making it a bit easier if the Brits will ask for it. But I'm not sure that their own... They want, at the end of the day, one, no, the single market must be kept as an integral single market, there is no cherry picking. One area gets a good deal, another area doesn't. You can't actually do that under trading rules anyway. So very difficult. And the problem at this side is that I think Theresa May and David Davis don't seem to have heard what happened in the election. They're saying, oh, we're going to go ahead with hard Brexit.
John, just before we move on, we'll maybe sort of come back to this in a roundabout kind of way in a minute, but it's interesting that the Tories are still locked in negotiations with the DUP, of course, who have been very committed. This is the Ulster Unionist Party, very committed to maintaining Democratic Unionist Party, forgive me. Very committed to the soft border with the Republic of Ireland, of course. Is that relevant if we look at bargaining chips? Is it relevant that they were so committed to maintaining that? Because that's, of course, pretty fundamental to the continuation of free movement between what will be the sole UK European land border.
Yes, it's the whole Irish angle is complicated and intriguing. Remember, the new Toisak has just been sworn in just today. It's going to be, I think, you know, really quite difficult for the Republic of Ireland now to negotiate these things with a British government that includes the DUP. The DUP, of course, not the Republic's favourite party. Quite how this is going to work out, who knows? I mean, one of the idiocies is that neither side wants to have a hard border between Northern Ireland and the Republic, but that unless somebody can see a way out of the present quagmire, tragically, that might well happen.
Let's reflect on that point. Two of Britain's former prime ministers have stepped forward this week to offer some wisdom as Westminster adjusts to the surprise outcome of last week's election. First, Sir John Major, on this very point, warned against a partnership between May's Tories and the controversial DUP, shall we describe them as. Then her predecessor, David Cameron, made his first public utterances since his resignation following the Brexit referendum, saying it was time for May to listen to other parties. Quentin, the substance of both of those may or may not be valid, depending on where you stand. From the perspective of a prime minister, is public advice from your predecessors ever really welcome?
I think if a prime minister were sensible, he or she would actually encourage that and actually embrace such advice and say, I mean, hey, if I'm taking on a new job, I really want my predecessor to tell me how to do the job or something. But it doesn't often happen that way. It usually looks as if prime ministers, you know, say, oh, I don't want to have anything to do with that. Every single former British prime minister has came out during the referendum campaign and said, don't vote for Brexit. So I suspect that Theresa May, now having embraced this, is not terribly keen to hear from these people. She never had a good relationship with David Cameron anyway. It's actually quite poisonous, as we saw from the way that she got rid of his all that he's done. She's chucked out of the window, really. But I think that we should embrace these people. For goodness sake, they've had very real experience at these difficult things of governing, and that's precisely something on which Theresa May doesn't have much experience.
Yes, indeed, but the big difference is between giving the advice in private and giving it in public.
That speaks the diplomat.
I know from in government that previous prime ministers often give advice in private to current prime ministers, and usually the man in the job or the woman in the job finds this useful. Doing so in public is, of course, very different, especially when it's the kind of advice that John Major has been giving. There's a further twist to this. Remember that Jonathan Powell has said that John Major actually considered in his day a political arrangement of some kind with the DUP and turned it down on the very grounds that are now being put forward as concerns, that you cannot sit alongside the DUP and be an honest broker in the Northern Ireland peace process. And I think, you know, the number of people, not just prime ministers, who are saying louder and louder that if you go ahead with this deal, there is a risk that Northern Ireland descends back into violence, is going to make life very difficult for Theresa May.
So, I think that the DUP is a very dangerous partner for the government to bring in, both for the peace process. It's taking sides in the peace process, and actually for the Brexit negotiation process. Because even though on paper the DUP says we want a soft border, therefore we want a softer Brexit, we want to stay in the customs union, actually in their hearts, the DUP, of course, is passionately keen to have a real border, a very real border between the north and the south, because that's the identity of Northern Ireland as a separate place. So I'm not sure that at the end of the day, if push came to shove, they wouldn't give up the soft border in favour of keeping their identity in Northern Ireland.
I'm sure that's right. I think one of the intriguing things about the situation is how much better, how much more sophisticated the DUP's messaging has been than that of the Tory party, which of course has resources several multiples greater than that of the DUP. The other problem with the DUP is the personalities. I mean, these are 10 rather awkward people, as you know. And I love the comments coming out on various bits of Northern Irish radio that Theresa May used to describe herself as a bloody difficult woman, but that was before she met Arlene Foster.
Well, are they then, I mean, maybe personally then, maybe more apposite bedfellows, because May herself has proven rather, I don't know, awkward with the public. She doesn't, her likability ratings plummeted during the campaign. But in spite of that, do you think that then, if there is some awkward alliance that's formed, it can't endure? I mean, how many weeks or months do we see if they do manage to get this agreement through?
I wouldn't want to put a number on it, but I think we are talking months, perhaps, simply on the basis of history. I mean, this is not the first time that we've had a confidence and supply arrangement of this kind. I can't think of any example in the past that's lasted more than 6 months.
And just going back to this point about our former leaders chipping in, do you think, Quentin, I sense this from what you said before, that actually there's also a question of the public reflection here. You know, David Cameron has made his pronouncement. We talked about John Major's remarks about the DUP. Are the public too quick to forget their former leaders? Should we be more reflective if John Major, for example, has something to say? Do you think the public say, hey, you know, you're the old political generation, we're not listening to you anymore?
Yeah, and the public and the media, I think, too, you know, your history, your toast, forget them. That's very sad. You know, the world is, of course, littered with organisations of former leaders trying to do good, you know, the wise old men here or the wise old birds, whatever, going around trying to make peace or whatever. Some, of course, have done really rather well. Jimmy Carter, who was never actually that great a US president, has actually been rather substantial as a peacemaker out of the president. John's going to disagree with me about Jimmy Carter.
But it's part of it just the passing of time. You often sense the fact that the longer it is since somebody was actually at the front line of political office, the more willing the public is to actually listen to what they say. Is there some truth to that, John?
Yes, I think there is. Anybody who's held public office tends to have some kind of stain on their reputation. You know, it's just you make a mistake. You don't necessarily do anything morally wrong, but things don't always go the way that you plan. Over time, people tend to forgive this. And psychologists tell us that one of the curious characteristics of almost all people is we tend to guard happy memories better than bad memories. So when you look back on the political career of the elders, you tend to think of them in much happier terms than you might have recognised actually at the time. So
it's
yes,
like how we remember our childhood, always the sun is shining, the sky is blue.
That's right.
Oh, I thought that was how it actually happened. Well, I'll take off my rose-tinted spectacles when we continue after a short break. We'll be talking about, is there a diplomatic way forward for Qatar? And we'll look at why world leaders often fail when trying to show that they're just having fun. Stay tuned.
Are you an entrepreneur, architect, city maker, shop owner, media player, property developer, or chef? Then you need a ticket to the most important conference on delivering quality of life in our cities. The Monocle Quality of Life Conference is back, and this year is touching down in Berlin. Join us from the 29th of June to the 1st of July for great debate, informative panels, engaging hospitality, and a chance to see the best of Berlin. Join us as we discover the developers who are rethinking the property world, how you can build stores that work in a click-and-shop world, what the most inspirational entrepreneurs are planning, how you make a hit restaurant or fragrance firm, the media brands to watch, how we can green our cities, the future of transport, and much more besides. Let's make better places to live. Join us. Be inspired. The Monocle Quality of Life Conference 2017. Head to conference.monocle.com to book your ticket.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Still with me, my guests, John Everard and Quentin Peel. Qatar's diplomatic isolation continues. Fears grow, too, of the knock-on effects. The United Nations Human Rights Chief raised concerns today over the possible impact on ordinary people in the country. Meanwhile, in Washington, mixed messages from Trump's inner circle and the Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson. Some fear the president's rather more aggressive stance could hinder US ability to effect any positive change in the region. John, we've already discussed your diplomatic experience, of course. This is all a bit of a mess and getting messier, isn't it?
Well, yes, it is. It need never have got here if President Trump had managed to sort of bite his tongue and not just vent when he was in Saudi Arabia. The Saudis would almost certainly not have been encouraged to put this blockade together against Qatar. And the mess between Trump and Tillerson is, of course, deeply embarrassing. I mean, Tillerson is, you know, for heaven's sake, he's run a major oil multinational. This is not a child. You do not expect to be treated like this, not least by somebody like Donald Trump. And you can't help wondering how much more of this Rex Tillerson is going to take, being undermined by a president just hours after you make serious pronouncements about the way forward. And in terms, we now learn that we're not discussed with anybody. Trump simply added something to his statement, which undermined everything that Tillerson had said just earlier that afternoon. This is really messy.
And Quentin, I'm sure, sat in these very chairs and talked about the unpredictability of Donald Trump and the fact that he is given to these unilateral pronouncements. But this is particularly concerning, isn't it? Because at the heart of all of this is, well, you could say there's this sort of proxy disagreement, if you want to call it that, between, say, Saudi Arabia and Iran. Hugely complex, so many different stakeholders. And Trump, one imagines, is stirring here without having, surely, a grasp of those big issues.
Oh, absolutely. And, I mean, there are 10,000 Americans in Qatar. It's a huge military base. And to be actually encouraging your other allies to be putting an embargo and a blockade on the place. I mean, the whole thing is very murky and, I think, very dubious. I think it was the ambassador of the UAE the other day trying to explain why they were doing this on Qatar. And right up front in his statement was, well, of course, this is where Al Jazeera comes from. And I have a feeling that almost more than anything else about Qatar's relations with Iran or, I mean, they're trying to blame Qatar for having too good relations both with Iran and ISIS, who are polar opposites, in fact, in what they represent. But actually, I think they hate Al Jazeera and the fact that Al Jazeera, which is really remarkably independent and really quite critical, and they don't like living with it, it's based fundamentally and financed from Qatar.
John, what happens next? If we stay on that DC point of view for a moment, you mentioned that Tillerson might just say, look, enough's enough. And he did seem to rather take a fair bit of convincing in the first place. How damaging would that be? We've already seen Trump having to cope with changes in personnel. And there's this sense of a almost continual narrowing of his cabal around him, smaller and smaller, to it's just family and friends. How damaging would it be if say Tillerson said, look, enough's enough, and did walk?
It would be very damaging. I mean, losing your Secretary of State within just a few months of taking office, it would be very hard to take the administration seriously, frankly. I mean, you know, with the number of people who've already disappeared into the wild, many of them, of course, with big clouds over them, and various ongoing investigations into things with Russia. I keep seeing now on kind of internal political American blogs, people talking about President Pence and Donald Trump as the comic warm-up act. And I'm starting to think there's more truth to that than the authors may have intended.
And Quentin, if we look back to the whole Gulf region, what about people saying, look, you know, this is a region that's hugely complex, there are all these tensions there, this is really just, you know, pricking the surface of something that could be incredibly damaging. I mean, is that scaremongering? Could this be an unravelling. We have the sort of Gulf cooperation agreements and these sorts of things. They're not under threat from this level of antagonism, are they?
Well, I just think it's another level of serious unpredictability in a region which is, as we all know, a tinderbox. And none of the fundamental tensions have been resolved at all. And the US is showing no sign of doing much about it. I think the other problem is that actually where else is diplomatic initiatives coming from? I mean, Britain totally obsessed by this Brexit exercise and so on, so not really able, and also put in as foreign minister with Boris Johnson, a man who doesn't understand the word diplomacy as far as one can see. Then, but Germany and France are also major elections this year. Their focus is not on it. Germany anyway doesn't, it's still building up, if you like, a real diplomatic prestige. It's not there yet. It doesn't. France does, but France is in the middle of elections and so on. So nobody's really focused on this. Maybe the pressure needs to go back to those much maligned organisations like the United Nations and Antonio Guterres, who has spoken out a bit on this and is a very sensible man. And then there's Federica Mogherini for the European Union, not so very visible, but nonetheless slowly perhaps building up some capacity.
John, would you agree with that? It's interesting. You're a seasoned diplomat. Are we in a bit of a international diplomatic lull? Has the wind gone from the sails of your art?
Well, temporarily, yes. I mean, the travails of American diplomacy are well recorded. British diplomacy, I think. It sounds bureaucratic, but the fact that a department for exiting the European Union was created is important. That means that whole, you know, very preoccupying area of problems is taken out of the diplomatic service, which can then concentrate on, so to speak, the rest of the world. So British diplomacy, I think, you know, is still in there. But I don't think London really knows what to do about Qatar. They remember that Qatar has got an immense influence in London, just because of the amount of property it owns. What, the Shard, One Hyde Park, Harrods, to name but a few. And I think the... You know, anything that would smack of siding with the Saudis, of course, another major UK ally against Qatar, would be very difficult for the Foreign Office. France, yes, in the middle of elections right now. Macron, clearly, it's fast. Give the guy a couple of weeks, maybe he'll start pitching in there. So, no, I don't think the art is dead. It's just...
It's just resting its eyes for a few minutes.
Yes, that's right.
Time is short, but let's talk briefly about world leaders. We've mentioned a few in passing. Great power, huge responsibility, extraordinary diplomatic access. But they like to try and convince us most of the times that they're just like the rest of us, and they often go to great efforts to try and make that point. But that tends to be where things go wrong. British Prime Minister Theresa May, her again, learned that the hard way. She attempted a Mexican wave at a football match in Paris last night, as badly timed as the election, one wag was heard to observe. Should leaders worry less about trying to be fun or be perceived as having fun, Quentin? Is it always pregnant with difficulty?
It awfully often is, I think. I mean, one has cringe-worthy exercises. As we saw Theresa May, but also in the last election, Ed Miliband, trying to eat on the run, pop food from stalls and making an awful mess of it in front of the cameras. So I would say, on the whole, don't go there. Don't kiss babies and don't eat hamburgers with a lot of ketchup in the streets.
Absolutely.
And John, it's a fair point, isn't it? I mean, we ask for statesmanlike men and women. Play the statesman. Why do they constantly feel the need to show that they're a salt of the earth character?
Better still, don't play anything at all. Just be yourself.
That'll never catch on, John, surely.
Well, it's a long shot, but I think it'll make the world a better place. All this trying to look as if you're just like an ordinary person is never going to convince anybody. Prime ministers, presidents just aren't.
There you go. I can't possibly end the show better than that. My thanks to John Everard. My thanks to Quentin Peel for being with us on today's edition of Midori House, which was produced by Ben Rylan, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Fiametta Cessna, and our studio manager was Toby Hammond. More music next, Entrepreneurs at 1900, and we will have more on all the big news stories of the day on the Monocle Daily. That is coming your way at 2200. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Thank you for listening.